G'day, Dons fans. Gather Round turned out to be not much of a gathering at all, with the Dons falling to 2-2 after a big loss to the Power last Friday night at the Adelaide Oval. The focus now turns to redemption, and joining me in the Don the Stat studio to preview our Round 5 clash against the Western Bulldogs is Ian Hume. Humey, how are you, mate?
Mate, look, I'm good. Despite the result on Friday, things are pretty good here in the Hume household. How about yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. The week's never quite as good after a loss as it is after a win. But yeah, thankful that I've got lots of other things in life to distract me from footy. And yeah, dog that still needs working and walking, I should say, and lots of work that still needs to be done. And I was going to say sun comes up, but it hasn't really come up all that often in Melbourne this week. But no, mate, I'm pretty good, thank you.
Yeah, and it was actually great to be over in Adelaide for Gather Round, despite the Essendon result. And if I take off my Essendon goggles and just consider the experience as a whole, I thought it was fantastic the way in which the round is structured over there. I got to 7 of the 9 games, and I never got sick of the football. So it did help that other than probably the day of our games, the Friday games, most of the games had some level of interest all the way to the end there. Getting to each of the grounds, they all have their own charm, and Adelaide really is the perfect city to do that sort of thing. It's just the right size. And you look, it's something I know people are a bit down on the concept, and it's, again, it is a marketing thing, and people can get a bit sick of footy as a marketing exercise. But I think if you do like your footy generally, I think it's something you should try and get to at least once, and do try and get to all of the venues. It does make the experience a lot better. The people, everyone was really friendly, even the Port supporters for the most part. I don't think you'd be disappointed if you made the trip over and got to a few of the games. It's a really great experience. Just want to say thanks to my friend Trent, who organised most of the trip, and also for being a gracious Port fan in victory, as well as shout-outs to Jamie, Danny and Andrew, who I did manage to catch up whilst there, as well as to John, who I just missed out on seeing. It was just great seeing so many Essendon fans out there representing the club at other games. You always saw Essendon merchandise at any of the games. As I said, it was a fantastic experience.
Yeah, I mean, the AFL made no secret of this being a cash grab or a marketing ploy, did they? They introduced this round really to fund the increase in the salary cap that the players wanted and the clubs wanted around the soft cap increase as well. So, yeah, it was done purely for commercial reasons. But I have to admit, I had some serious gather round FOMO, mate, seeing the fun that you were having and others. So, yeah, I'm going to make sure I clear my work calendar next year so I can get there. And, yeah, despite the result in our game, mate, I'm glad you had a great time.
Well, look, before we get into reviewing the Port game, as always, we want to give a big shout-out to everyone who's joined our Patreon this week. So thanks to Braden Ogies, Christopher Bond, John Bate and Mark Hanber for signing up and showing your support. It's always great to see the responses that are coming up in the community chat from the games, the reactions to our First Thought post-game reactions, although I've been absent the last couple of weeks and I will be back this week. So if you've been missing me in those, don't fret, I'll be there. And thanks, everyone, for participating in the voting for the Jack Kirby medal. It's going really well so far.
Yeah, I've been missing you in those, mate. Despite what some people might think, I don't particularly like the sound of my own voice, so it'll be good to have you back and joining me on those. But yeah, thanks everyone who has jumped on you and everyone who continues to support. We really appreciate it. It was a pretty wild week this week on social media for Essendon fans, or by Essendon fans, was it? Wasn't it? And yeah, justifiably so. And yeah, I have to say that the Donnerstadt Patreon community kept me pretty sane this week at, having people to talk to and share different perspectives without too much of the hysteria and toys being thrown out of the cot, which I'm really grateful for. So yeah, thank you for that. But anyway, mate, this part's not going to be fun. Let's get into it. Rip the Band-Aid off, as we say, and let's talk through that pretty horrible loss to Port Adelaide.
Yeah, look, well, it started well with a really positive first quarter. We seem to match them as much, but look, I'm sure after that first quarter, every Essendon fan's reaction to the remainder of that game was,
"What the hell was that?"
Well, look, we're now a week removed and we're in the cold light of, well, evening now as we record. And I guess we have to look at what the hell that was and what we can actually take out of it. So, look, let's start with the obvious. And we spoke about this pre-game, the importance of clearances, both to the ability of the way we play our game and the fact that Port have quite a strong clearance group as well. And we knew that it was going to be very difficult to win if we weren't at least breaking even when it came to those clearances. Well, if you're watching the game, you didn't need to have a look at the stats to know that Essendon got trounced in the middle, but they paint a pretty stark picture. So We're down 19 centre clearances to six. That differential of 13 is the biggest so far this year in any game. Only other time there's been a double-figure difference in centre clearances was Gold Coast's win over Richmond in opening round. It's also the biggest centre clearance differential Essendon has conceded since 2022, where we did go down in that stat 14 against North in round 20, although that was a match we did end up winning by 48 points, a much different Essendon and a much different North at that time. Power kicked 4 goals 2 direct from centre clearance compared to Essendon's 1 goal 1. Jason Horne-Francis had 7 on his own, which was one more than what Essendon had as a team, whilst Rosie had 4 and Soldo had 3, and no Essendon player got more than one centre clearance. We did come into this game as the number one centre clearance side, and we really need to think about what went wrong. When we were doing all right in the first quarter, it was 5 centre clearances to 3, so we were somewhat breaking even there, but after quarter time, it was 14 to 3, and we tried a lot of different combinations. So we had 17 centre bounce combinations this week. That's more than we've had at any stage this year. Stringer had his first centre bounce attendances for the year. He played majority of time there in the second quarter. We had Jai Caldwell come in there a lot more than he has done in previous weeks. So it wasn't like we weren't trying different options to try and contain the centre clearance dominant support. It's just nothing seemed to work. You were watching the game at home. Could you pinpoint any particular cause as to why we had such an utter trouncing in that area?
Yeah, where do you start? I mean, let's start with our rucks. I think it was a really poor showing from our two ruckmen. And you know, I think we, as you know, a team or a club and or you know, coaching group, playing group, and myself, not that, you know, what I think really matters in the end result, but I think we really underestimated Soldo and his capabilities. I'm not a super coacher, and nor do I really understand how super coach points work. But just for demonstrative purposes, Soldo had 92 super coach points for the game. Our two ruckmen had 65 between them, and within that, Sam Draper had just 15. So, yeah, he outperformed both of our ruckmen on his own by a substantial way, and you know, there was none of that assertiveness or aggressiveness or dare I say the edge about, you know, how we wanted or expect our ruckman to play. You know, they had the opportunity to really, you know, tag team him, beat him up and you know, be real physical presence around the ball, and we didn't get any of that. So that was really disappointing. Then there was their actual ruck work. You know, we won the hitouts, but hitouts to advantage were 12-5 in Port Adelaide's favour. 52% of the hitouts Soldo won went to the advantage of his midfielders, whereas our two went at just 20% and 7%, Goldstein and Draper respectively. So, I think our ruckman really let us down, and we didn't get anything or anywhere near enough out of them. But I don't think that hit out to advantage was or result was just about the rucks, to be honest. It wasn't just about their ruck skill. I think it was also, you know, the fault of our midfielders, who for much of the night were really flat footed. They were reactive. There was, you know, there was the lack of physicality from our rucks, but also from our mids, and the lack of reward for winning the hit out, I think, is largely on, you know, the responsibility of our mids, who, you know, just underperformed, and we didn't get a lot of movement or any at all really through the clearance, and that just made it really hard once we did win a tap to take the ball away. You touched on the different combinations. I think we overcooked that a little bit. Our coaches, I expect, anticipated that Drew would go to Merritt. We started Merritt at half forward, hoping that might draw Drew out of the midfield. But I don't think that was ever likely to happen, given that Wines was out. And, you know, we spoke about that in our preview, that, you know, they were going to need Drew more than ever at the coalface, given that. And, yeah, that was the way that played out. So I think we just outsmarted ourselves a little bit. Zach went back into the midfield from the third centre bounce. And, yeah, as you said, we rotated heavily. But I just don't think we allowed our mids to settle into the game with our better combinations from the start and then look to layer it from there. And, yeah, I think in trying to maybe confuse Port a little bit and throw some different things at them, we probably confused ourselves and didn't get any real continuity or patterns going through the game.
Yeah, going back and watching that for the centre bounce data that I've been tracking this year, it was really noticeable just how reactive and again, really easily pushed under the ball. We're so conscious of our opponents that we let ourselves not take any opportunity, not take the opportunities that were presented to ourselves, or we second guess the way in which we exited stoppage. And even when we did get first hands on the ball, we often coughed it up very quickly because of that. Jeff White, the former Melbourne and Fremantle ruckman, posted an interesting video on Twitter, which was looking at the power setup at the centre bounce and really showed how the power left themselves a lot of space to let their burst runners in Jason Horne-Francis and Rosie to run onto the ball. And then obviously, because they're at pace, they're able to get past the defenders and get out there. I'll include a link to that post there because it is an interesting video and he does a really good breakdown of the way in which the centre bounce went the way it did. If you think about that, where you've got these burst runners and they're giving themselves a lot of space, is there a way to combat this structurally, or does it just require having better quality players that we don't have access to at this stage?
Yeah, a little bit of irony in that one, mate. I did see that clip and it was, Jeff did a really good job. I spent the whole week of 2000 grand final week analysing Jeff White and watched, and this isn't an exaggeration, I watched every single one of his ruck contests across that season and cut up a lot of tape for John Barnes and Steve Alessio to watch in the preview to the grand final. We felt that he was the player that could, the area of the ground that we thought that, they had a real advantage and he was the real threat. So, it was interesting seeing him now on the other side of the fence and doing some analysis himself. But in terms of what happened on Friday night, I think two things for me, mate. I think we underappreciated the value and the impact that Drew has. It was interesting to see, not that I put a lot of value in Champion Data's ranking stats, but Drew's ranked inside the top 10 players in the competition so far this year. He had the most contested possessions to the game. Of his 21 possessions in total, 17 of them were contested. So yeah, Rosie, Butters, Horne-Francis, they're dynamic players. They're like Stringer, the best of Jake Stringer, 2021 Jake Stringer in the midfield, Jake Stringer. Tough players to stop once they get on the move. And we seemed really conscious of the three of them. And in doing so, we kind of just ignored Drew and let him do what he does. And then in doing that, we also lost our own structure and intent for the ball. And it'll be really interesting to see how we adapt against the Dogs because they have a similar proposition through their midfield. I think we needed to do more to stop the ball at the source, disrupt their disruptor, and play to our own strengths. And we didn't see anything particularly offensive about, well, it was offensive to watch, but not offensive in the terms of trying to attack the game in how any of our other mids played. And then if we just take away the centre bounces for a moment, which is where they did so much of the damage. But, their 4-on-4 contests at stoppages around the ground, which weren't as much of a problem for us in terms of winning it. We won those 20-14. So it was a much more even contest. But we ended up getting outscored. We've been able to score from stoppages and take the ball away or take the ball away from there and score. We weren't able to do that either. Stoppage scores were 7-13. So, they ended up outscoring us by a goal despite the fact that we won four more of them. We don't have a Butters or a Rosie or a Horne-Francis through our midfield. That's true. Perkins is maybe our one that could rise to those levels. Unfortunately, he's going to be out for a little while. That's a really impressive trio, but we did have the midfield depth to outwork them and outlast them. Jackson Mead was the only other midfielder that they used. If we were able to do more to stop the ball at the source, got more from our rucks, and then played more of the game on our own terms and to our own strengths, and we didn't really do any of that. We just allowed Port to get the game on their own terms. Drew went to work, rest of their mids got on top. We got nothing out of our rucks, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, exactly. And once we lost that territory from the centre bounce, and that's what was so important in the win over the Saints the previous week, it became very difficult for us to move the ball. And that was my big fear going into the games, that we were coming up against a well-drilled Port side with a range of intercepting options. Houston, Aaliyah, we know what Brandon Zerkthatcher can do. Radaglia was everywhere. And then Port really did a lot of work in shutting down our options to move the ball from half back. They put a lot of time into Andy McGrath, with Darcy Byrne-Jones playing that lockdown role on him, and that limited McGrath to 16 disposals, particularly after what he did against the Saints the previous week. Mason Redmond has had very little impact this year, and whilst Nick Martin is trying hard and still coming to terms with a new role, he can't do it all himself. And I also think that it's not necessarily the problem with those three. Those are our prime movers from half back. I actually think it's more about what's happening up the field and not giving these players the options that they need in order to get the ball out of that danger zone. And what aren't we doing to allow these players to be more creative off half back, Jono?
Well, we're not adapting too much to situations within games. We mentioned last week that Burne Jones might go to Nick Martin. In the end, it was McGrath that went to. McGrath had a really dirty night. He didn't handle that situation particularly well. It is a feather in his cap that he got the attention that he did, and is testament to, you know, the shifts that he put in the first 3 weeks of the season. We transitioned from defensive 50 to our own forward 50 just 8 times for the game. The AFL average is 9.7. So we weren't particularly effective in going forward. It's been a problem for us in all four of our games, to be honest. It wasn't a unique thing on the night. We turned the ball over 30 times in our defensive half of the ground, which is, and 6 times in our own defensive 50. For context, that's 7 more defensive half turnovers than we had against St Kilda. So 7 times we gave the ball back to Port Adelaide in their forward half of the ground. 7 times more, I should say, than we did the previous week against St Kilda. It was 5 more than we did against Sydney, and it was 6 more against than against Hawthorn. So not only did we have this problem of getting beaten by a really impressive midfield and you know, losing territory, we then consistently gave the ball back to Port Adelaide in dangerous parts of the ground. And I think part of that is also what's happening, or what happened with the midfield. When your mids are spending so much of the game being reactive and chasing tail, you then lose them on offensive transition because they're fatigued, they're out of position, they're not presenting at the ball carrier, they're still trying to find their opponent or chasing pressure. So there was no connection between our backs and mids, or our rucks for that matter. And then we didn't get a lot from our forwards coming up the ground. And then, you know, it was a part of the game that we just didn't adjust to. And, you know, we didn't do anything to free McGrath up, or to free someone else up and, you know, maybe use Redmond in a bit more of an offensive role. We chose to just try and let the game, or let the job that Burne Jones was doing on McGrath just sort of play out. And yeah, maybe that's part of McGrath developing and learning, and that's why the coaches let it go. But I think, you know, we also could have looked at some options to try and find other avenues to move the ball out of our back 50.
Yeah. And again, something that also keeps showing up, you know, this year and in previous years is the lack of contested marking around the ground that we have, or at the very least to create a contest. And that when you haven't got those easy options out of halfback, that needs to be your go-to going to your big contested marking forward or contested marking ruckman that can create that contest and potentially either get a stoppage further up the ground or take a contested mark and really open things up further up. And we only took 5 contested marks for the game, and that was compared to the Powers 12. 3 of our contested marks came from our defenders, and it was only Jones and Caldwell that took a contested mark from those further up the field. So, as I said, it makes it really hard when you come up against teams with excellent defensive zones to be able to move the ball. And in particular with that, sort of building on that, it was something that was mentioned by both the Power coaching staff and the commentators, was that after quarter time, the Power actually just went man on man against the Bombers. They weren't so worried about their zone there. I guess, touching on the contested marking side of it and that idea of the man on man, you know, in some sense, it makes sense in terms of what it means, but I guess what does it mean in terms of how the team's playing as opposed to playing that zone, and what was the potential weaknesses for them in going for that we couldn't capitalize on?
Yeah, I mean, we're ranked 13th in the competition now for contested marks going, and that was partly because of what happened on Friday night. Going into the game, we were ranked 7th and just above the AFL average. So, you know, you don't want to be average. You want to be right up towards the top, obviously. But it wasn't a part of our game that was a massive, massive issue for us in the first 3 weeks. But it certainly became a big issue for us on Friday night. I thought Jones backed up his performance from the previous week. If we can just touch on that briefly, he took the most marks of any player on the ground. So I think in my mind, at least, we give him a pass. You know, that's 2 really solid games for him now, and he's building, which is great. Honestly, don't know how much of what Port did with their back six and how it worked out for them was what they did, and how much of it was because of our lack of structure forward of the ball. Also the delivery to our forwards. There weren't a lot of kicks that were weighted to the favoured side in those one-on-one contests. We did make it pretty easy at times for Port defenders. I think though, I think what Port were ultimately trying to do, I think, was that they wanted to take our ball control away from us, remove any hit-up targets through the middle of the ground. So they like to free up Alirelire as their main intercepting defender, use him to create two on ones. He drops off and helps out their other defenders. So they were prepared to sacrifice that so that they could put more pressure up forward to the ground and take away our hit-up options. And they did that. They absolutely did it and did it really well. And then without us getting any impact from, our other forwards or our rucks in the air, without the run from behind, we spoke about the job that Burnt Jones did on McGrath, another quiet game from Mason Redmond. And, let's face it, without Peter Wright as well, maybe it would have looked different for Port if he was there. And just not putting any real pressure on those one-on-ones, we didn't give ourselves an opportunity to really expose, those one-on-one contests. So, again, like it was in the midfield and every other part of the game after quarter time, it was just a real recipe for disaster. They took a gamble, it paid off for them, and we weren't composed or effective enough to try and put it under any real sort of pressure.
Yeah, obviously a lot of doom and gloom coming out of this Port game after a fairly positive first 3 weeks. But related to coming out of that Port game, you wanted to reflect on some of the experience from other sports. And look, one of your only flaws as a human being is that you're an Arsenal supporter. But because you're an Arsenal supporter, you remembered something that Tim Cahill said, something about Arsenal a few years back, where they were sort of in a rebuilding phase under a new coach that you think is relevant to consider after the game against Port.
Thank you, mate. I think there's probably some people out there, and including myself, that would argue I have more than just the one flaw, but arguably being an Essendon supporter is one of them as well. But yeah, this actually popped up in my feed during the week, mate, because as you would know, as a Tottenham supporter, Arsenal are on top of the league at the moment. And I found it interesting. It was something that, as you mentioned, Tim Cahill, the Aussie Socceroo legend, said in his role as a pundit after a match that Arsenal lost in Mikel Arteta's second season in charge as manager or coach. Let's have a bit of a listen to it now. It only goes for a couple of minutes, and then I'll explain why I think it's relevant.
Motivation point.
No, when Roy talks about not needing motivation himself, the changing room that he was in, he's a leader, right? And what I'm going to say here,
in my mind, about when I was 8, 9 years of age.
But Roy, the key, what I'm saying, there is no leaders out there. There's no leadership, and Roy's talking about actions. That could be a tackle. That could be on the front foot. That could be like pull the line up. That could be like clearing a ball off the line. Roy's talking about players that he's played with influence that influence the game through actions, and I can understand that. But when you watch Arsenal against Leicester, and you see the high press, how aggressive they were. In this half here, Arsenal were just outside the 18-yard box on a corner, all four. And they were trying to suffocate them, press them in, win the second ball, win the third ball. Surely you're prepped for that.
We're building Arsenal up to be some sort of... Arsenal lost to Leicester.
Yeah, but they won.
And they lost to... But you mentioned
but
the
you
high
what?
Press. They lost.
You know
did they lose to Leicester?
They lost.
Did they lose to Leicester?
They know why
Brilliant.
They lost.
That's what
because,
they get. That's the name of the game.
Mikel knows the reason why they lost.
Mikel has
they
lost
missed,
three games
They
this
missed
season.
Their chances in the first half. They missed their chances in the first half. Lacazette, right on the line.
How many league games have Arsenal lost this season?
Listen, but the key thing is, Arsenal are progressing because there's an identity. There's a formula to the way they play. They play out from the back, and they'll keep playing out from the back. And that's why I think Mikel deserves a lot of praise. And I agree with you with the leadership. These players playing for one of the biggest clubs
question.
In the world shouldn't need
motivation. How many games have Arsenal lost this season?
They've lost a few games, but they know why they've lost.
Right.
Yeah, but there's three, but they know why they've lost. They finished the game and
they know why they lost.
Yeah, but they finished the game and they're learning.
They wanted to win it against a poor United team.
And
all of a sudden, Arsenal, the new Bayern Munich.
Yeah.
Do me a favour.
Yeah, I know.
They've lost
Roy,
to Liverpool, Manchester City.
So you kind of have to ignore the attempts to derail what Tim Cahill's saying by, the Sam McClure equivalent of EPL media. But he's commentating on Arsenal lose or making comment on Arsenal losing that game, but playing a game style that the coach wants them to play. And, they weren't able to execute it on the day, not enough to win the match. And he makes a comment about how they lack leaders and effectively lack the talent to carry out that game plan at the time. But you only find that out in reality in implementing the game plan that you want to play and find out what the capabilities that you do and don't have on your list. And I think that's where Essendon is at the moment. I think there's some real synergies in the comments that Tim was making about Arsenal at the stage and where we're at. We adjusted how we play halfway through last season. We've spoken about that a lot before. We've taken that to another level in 2024. There were patches against Sydney. There was the second half against St Kilda where we really saw it. And it won us the game. There was the first quarter against Port Adelaide where I think we were all really proud of the effort and what it looked like. We couldn't put the score on the board, but we saw what the plan was and the brand and the attack at the contest and being really aggressive from half back. It led to Port making a change. We just spoke about that, going man on man so they could get more pressure through the middle of the ground. We wanted to lock the ball in the front half. I think we mentioned in our first thoughts, or I mentioned in our first thoughts, we had 8 forward 50 tackles, I think from memory in the first quarter. And the AFL average is about 9 or 10 in a game. So that first quarter was really, really good. What we're learning now is who is capable of playing in that system. We learned last year that Snelling wasn't capable. People were scratching their heads why he kept getting games. He played 15 games for the year in a wing and half forward role and he wasn't particularly effective, but we found out whether he was capable or not of helping us move forward. And in the end, he didn't have his contract renewed. Realistically, we could have done more to keep D'Ambrosio if we felt he was the answer to the problem, but we didn't. I think that there was a bit of an indication there that we felt that he didn't particularly fit the system that we wanted to play. We stamped the papers of some other untried, younger players who didn't meet the brief. And when you don't have an identifiable brand, or you're adjusting the way that you play because of a lack of quality on your list, you don't give yourself the opportunity to really understand who can and can't take you forward. And I think we have that brand now. We're playing it. We're not seeing it for long enough in games. Port Adelaide took it away from us because Port Adelaide's a really good team and we didn't have enough players who lived up to the challenge. And I think in continuing to go down that path, we get the opportunity to see it live and learn each and every week. And I know that's not a word that we like to hear as Essendon fans, but of who is capable of playing a role and fulfilling that brand and who isn't. And I just think that's where Essendon's at the moment. We know we don't have a list capable of winning a flag this year or really pushing the top teams for long enough. But we do have a brand that, when it's played out, is capable of troubling some teams. And we saw that in the first quarter in Port Adelaide. Now what we need to do is learn what players are capable of fulfilling that for longer, what aren't, and then continue to bring players onto our list that can help us achieve more.
Yeah, well said. And I think building on that, I wanted to address something that's been bugging me this week around the discourse around Jake Kelly. And I do listen to a lot of the other Essendon podcasts. I'm a fan of most of them. But I think that, and seeing other people's posts on social media, there's obviously a lot of consternation about Jake Kelly's continued selection. And I get that he's frustrating many at the moment with his role on the wing that he's playing and the way he's executing that role. He's copying a heap of criticism, some of it fairly. And some of it, I think, unfairly at this stage. So I want to approach his selection holistically and amount of defense of why he's continually being selected at this stage. So firstly, for the main reason, in my view, that he started on the wing comes down to the role we're trying to get Nick Martin into. It's, from my viewing, of matched him in preseason and the practice matches, Kelly's primary function is to act as that defensive cover for Martin so that Martin can get aggressive off the half-back line. A lot of people are wondering why Martin can't stay on the wing and still get aggressive. And I think there's two real issues with that. One is that, as we've seen, we really like good ball movement from halfback, particularly the type that can penetrate good zones. And Martin's one of the best kicks and hardest workers in the side. He's really well placed to assist in that role. It's clear he still needs more time to work to learn the position, but early signs are somewhat positive in this aspect. Secondly, the plan isn't for Martin to get so many of his possessions in the back 50s he's been getting. He's meant to be getting higher up the ground into more dangerous areas, which will then allow Kelly to fall back and cover his man and make sure we don't get found out defensively on those quick turnovers if Martin has pushed up the ground. Unfortunately, because of the way we've played the past couple of weeks, Martin hasn't been able to get further up the ground, which means Kelly has been stuck in that wing position and not really being able to play the role that we've envisioned for him. I think the other thing when it comes to Martin and moving him back to the wing, when it does come to the wing position, it's really easy for wings to be overlooked by the play in modern footy. They play such an important structural role, keeping their width and covering for the switch. And you'll often see games where the ball just stays on one side of the ground for large periods of time. And if you've got a player like Martin stuck out on the other wing, he's not involved in the game. And you want a player of Martin's quality to be involved as much as possible. Now, that's a lot easier to be done at halfback than on the wing consistently. So then moving him to halfback and asking him to get aggressive in that place where he can get more of the ball, it requires adding more defensive cover. And whilst not a natural winger, obviously, Kelly is a natural defender. And he also has the work rate and endurance to get up and back down the ground to act as that cover. So I think that's why he's there, and that's why he's still there, despite it not seeming to work at the moment. And the other thing for me to consider is to go back to the language that Brad Scott was using during the preseason about our players living an AFL lifestyle. It's clear based on Brad's assessment that a lot of players, at least before this season, aren't working and living as required in order to get the best out of themselves. And I think you look at the decision to give only Harry Jones only 1 year contract at the end of last year as a sign that certain players are on notice. And what we've seen of Jones over the last 2 weeks is that he's clearly been knuckling down and trying to get more out of himself to perform at a consistent level. Hopefully he can do that for the remainder of the season and really lock in this place for himself. But that brings me back to Kelly. There's not as many players who train as hard or prepare as well as Jake does. He wouldn't have an AFL career if he wasn't as hard a worker as he was. He's not the most talented player, but he clearly works hard and strives really hard to get the best out of himself. And if you think about the players on our list, he's probably in the top five of those who do the work to live an AFL lifestyle. He's up there with people like the Zach Merritts and the Peter Wrights who put in a lot of work to make sure they can perform at their best. And so I would summarize that one of the key reasons that he's consistently selected at the moment over more talented players or football talented players is that a message is being sent to certain players that if you want to make the AFL side, you need to put in the effort off the field that someone like a Kelly does to ensure you're selected each week. It's about creating that off-field culture that we all want to develop into order to ensure that we become a club that can build for long-term success. And I think Kelly is there as an example of the work that is required to be an AFL player. And if you want to get past him into his spot, you've got to work as hard as he does.
Yeah, well said, mate. I get some of the frustration with some of his execution, but I think there's three things here for mine. I think firstly, he's out of contract at the end of the year, so we have a list management decision to make it at the end of the year where we're pushing forward with a new system, a new game plan, and a new way of playing. And we're only in the early stages of that, really. Like we did last year with Snelling, you know, the only way to find out whether he's capable of playing a role in that system is by actually playing him in the first place. So all the things that you just said are spot on, plus there's that. We need to find out about him, whether he's capable of playing in this new role. Secondly, as you touched on, it's a sacrificial role. It's a team role. It's not about high disposals. It's about running up and down the ground to close space, both when we go inside 50, to slow the ball coming out, and then get back into defensive 50 when the opposition do transition to help our defenders. It's also about creating space from others, which at times means leaning away from the ball and you know, removing that instinct of see ball and try and get it and actually create space for others. And also, you know, at times getting involved and linking up in chains. I'm not necessarily sure you want a young, really talented player, someone like Sardis, who I think is the name that most people throw up when they think that Kelly out, Sardis in. I'm not sure you want him playing a sacrificial role, one that's, you know, purely about system and structure. Ideally, you'd have players in this role, you know, like Mason Wood at St Kilda, like Cottrell at Carlton, that can get involved in offensive transition and hit the scoreboard. I think that's ultimately what you want from your wingers. I think we're starting to get that more and more from Dersma. He's getting better with every week. That's not Kelly's game. He's doing the sacrificial part well, but, you know, not necessarily that offensive part. I think thirdly, and this is, you know, where you really went to town on, and I think you're right, if you want to set standards on work rate and professionalism and effort, and you want to talk about things like, you know, the term that gets thrown around a lot is, you know, selection integrity, then
you need to keep players that give you that despite their shortcomings with talent, that continue to give you high effort, high professionalism, and high work rate week in, week out, because that becomes the example to the guys who aren't getting a game. And you know, like you said, it's up to the next group in line now to reach that level and knock him out of the side. And you know, if that's driving the Archie Roberts of the world to have the performances that we're starting to see of him in the VFL, then that's what building a good football culture around professionalism and work rate is all about.
Yeah, hopefully we can start seeing, you know, those other players really pushing for those positions and building that talent profile. But until then, the hard workers and the people who put in the time should be picked so that you do create incentives for other players to work that hard. Look, the other big issue to come out of the game was what happened with Jeremy Finlayson and what he said to one of the other players, making use of a serious homophobic slur. It's really sad that this sort of thing still happens, but I think one positive to take out of it, there was a pretty clear reaction to what was said, both by the Essendon players and the general footy community at large, that this sort of behaviour is unacceptable. It doesn't matter whether it was said to a gay or a straight player, and really it's no business of ours as to who it was said to. Just the nature of that sort of language and the way it was said creates an environment where people feel unsafe to be who they are. So we have to have that zero tolerance to it. I think 3 weeks is suspension is probably a fair outcome considering this, and it does send a clear message to the rest of the competition and to all footy competitions around the country, because I'm sure this sort of thing goes on in, you know, local competitions and other levels of footy, and any sport around that. This sort of behaviour is unacceptable in Australian rules football and society in general going forward.
Yeah, well said, mate. I honestly don't have anything to add. I think, yeah, you sum that up really, really well. I think, well, I lie. I do have something to add. I can't help myself. I thought the leadership that Kyle Langford showed was really strong and really important. And the words that he used, how articulate he was, I think they're really impactful. I think it's a strong indication of where the culture of our own playing group is heading. You know, work to do on a lot of areas of our game, of course, but I think yeah, his reaction and the way that he spoke during the week was a really strong indicator that we've got someone of real class and integrity among the senior leaders of our group, which, you know, I thought was really good to see.
Yeah, I was really pleased with how he, the strength of the message that he came out with there. Look, the other thing that came out this week was the media ecosystem once again showed there's no nuance when it comes to Essendon. We're either a premiership chance or a basket case, and sometimes these views are expressed within 2 or 3 days of each other. And look, I get that it's in the media's interest to catastrophize. I don't know if I said that right. I've written it down, and now I can't say it. I know it's in the media's interest to do this.
Catastrophize.
That's the word. I couldn't do it. I know that, they're incentivized to do things that drive clicks, and that creates the money. And Essendon, they always love to clickbait Essendon. There was the Kane Corns article today that had Essendon in the headline, and there was basically one mention of Essendon. The whole article was actually a Suns article, but it got me to click on it. So well done, Kane. You've got my money from that. But I think as Essendon fans, it's really important that we restart tuning this sort of criticism out, because it's reacting to these sort of hysterical outputs from the media. It's part of the reason that we've been unsuccessful for so long. We've reacted to poor showings, and you know, that these deep criticism from the media, and we've changed course, and we haven't given anything time to work. And you know, the current leadership may not eventually lead us to a premiership or success, and they shouldn't be immune from criticism, but we can't allow short-termism to take hold. Once again, there really needs to be time given to fix the long-term problems with this football club. And that's going to require something that I know we're all sick of hearing about, and it's all sick of being asked to have, but that's patience. And I think the big issues that both in terms of club structure and priorities, as well as the nature of the playing list and game plan, have been identified by the current leadership. And I'm sure they are working on solutions for these. However, you know, this may mean performances like Friday, whilst unacceptable, may occur. If you go back, I know I refer to clubs like Richmond and Melbourne a lot, but look, if you go to Richmond's second year under Hardwick, they lost 13 games in that year. The average margin in those losses were 40 points. There was 4 losses over 60 points in that. 7 years after that, they're raising the premiership. They took the long view. They worked out the problems at the club, and they reaped the rewards from that. So again, I'm not saying that, you know, in 7 years' time, Brad Scott's going to be raising the premiership cup, although I hope he does. But that's the sort of things we need to be considerate of, not these hysterical reactions to one game going forward.
Yeah, I've said it before. So again, I don't partake in a lot of AFL media, mate. So it's pretty easy for me to tune it out this week. I literally watched or seen none of it. Had a few clips sent to me, which I didn't watch. Shout out to my brother if he's listening. Look, the performance on Friday is deserving of criticism. There's no doubt about that, regardless of the cycle or the situation we're in or the team that we played against. It wasn't good enough, but I don't think we need to be told any of that. I think we all know that, and I'm sure the player group and the coaches do. Port were incredible, but we contributed to that. We also can't change any of it now. That's the thing about stats, which is ironic for a show that's called Don the Stat, and we talk a lot about them, is they just tell you what did happen, not necessarily what was meant to happen. And I think this comes back to the conversation that we had earlier. If we review Friday night as just a moment in time, as a single game of football, then yeah, it looks a mess and you'd cry yourself to sleep and give up. But if you review that under the guise of now knowing what good looks like for us in how we want to play and what reward comes with successfully implementing our structure. And I know St Kilda aren't, the best team in the AFL at the moment, but it is an example. It's the most recent example of we have, because it was, literally only, two games of football ago. Or even if we just review the first quarter in Port Adelaide, against Port Adelaide, where, other than putting the score on the scoreboard, we demonstrated what our best football can look like, then you have a baseline, you have a measuring stick on what you can measure good versus not good against. And I think we have that now because we have a method, a way that we want to play. And, that's a separate debate on whether it's the right way or otherwise, and there'll be subjective views on that. But I don't think we had that in the past, and that in its own right puts us in a better position than where we've been previously. I also think that we have a broader leadership group at the club now that won't blink because of that performance or listen to what's being said. I think, that those strong leaders know, the work that needs to be done. We've said it before. I think I'm confident that they're there for the right reasons and they're prepared to roll their sleeves up and do it properly and do it methodically and not stop until the job's done. We now have the opportunity to respond. Can't change the past, but we can change, what's in front of us. So yeah, speaking of which, mate, should we take a look at the Bulldogs?
Yeah. Another one of our bogey sides coming up two in a row. Well, look, let's talk about the Bulldogs, and after bowing out of the 2022 final series in the first rounds, the Dogs failed to make September action in 2023. They missed out on the top eight by half a game there. So far this year, they've had two wins and two losses, big wins over the Suns and the Eagles, whilst losing to the Demons in round one and the Cats in gather round, which we'll touch on in a little bit. The Dogs are a side that like to move the ball by hand. They kicked 1.39 times for each handball in 2023, and it's basically remained the same in 2024. So, they're one of the more common teams to move the ball by hand. But despite this, they're marking the ball far more than they did in 2023, which I find really interesting. They've gone from 88 marks per game to 109 in season 2024. So they are taking a lot more marks around the ground, even while still keeping the same level of kick handball. In 2023, they were generating four more inside 50s per game than their opponent. However, so far this year, they're breaking even. So they're giving up as many inside 50s as they are getting. Where they have improved, though, is the inside 50 efficiency. So they're up 4% of their own efficiency and down 4% for their opposition. So they're meaning they're finding it much easier to score when going inside 50, and they're also preventing their opposition from scoring as often. So even though their inside 50 numbers or differential has dropped back to zero, they're being far more efficient both in offense and defensive ends than they were last year.
Yeah, the Dogs are ranked 10th in the AFL this season for inside 50s, averaging 52.75 a game. We're ranked 13th, averaging 50.75 per game. So both teams are getting relatively low looks at goal. As you touched on, the Dogs are much more efficient once they get it in there than we have been. They're ranked 4th in the AFL for efficiency once inside 50. We're ranked 12th. At the other end, they're 3rd for preventing scores once inside the defensive 50, and we're 16th. So in terms of creating opportunities to go inside 50, both of these teams are pretty evenly matched. what then happens, you know, we've got some work to, you know, some work to do, and the Dogs are proving so far that they're pretty good at it. All of that said, if you took a snapshot of the data after 3 weeks, it looked a little bit better for us than obviously it did after what happened on Friday.
Yeah. One area that the Dogs have historically been strong at is in clearance. So in 2023, they were the fourth in center clearance and first in stoppage clearance differential. However, they have dropped back somewhat in 2024. They're ranked 9th for center clearance and 7th for stoppage. Their contested possessions remain strong. However, they're plus 6.65 in 2023. They're still at plus 3.5 in 2024. So a little bit of a drop back. But in terms of rankings, both of those numbers are in the top four in the comp. So their contested game is still relatively strong, although their clearance numbers have dropped back a little bit. If you consider their intercept differential, so they're actually down 2.25. So that's lower than last year, but they are effective at creating more opportunities in forward 50 than their opponents. So they take three more inside 50 marks a game than their opponents, and they're tackling five more times inside 50 than their opponents. They're a bit harder to measure against because it's not, you don't have the same opportunity. So with clearance, both sides have the opportunity to win at the same clearance. When one side is going for an inside 50 mark, the other side isn't trying to take an inside 50 mark. They're trying to take a defensive 50 mark, and the same applies in terms of tackle. So they're not always a direct comparison there, but it is interesting that they're being far more effective in their forward lines than their opponents. And that partly explains why their efficiency numbers are the way they are.
Yeah, they're 13th in the AFL for intercept differential. We're 15th, so there's not a lot of difference there, but they are number one in the AFL for intercept marks, averaging 20.5 per game. And, you know, you're pretty happy to be able to intercept the ball by any method, but intercept marks is the real key, because you get the opportunity to reset. You can go back behind your mark, slow the game down if you want to. You're not under instant pressure to move the ball on. They're ranked number one in the AFL for intercept marks in their defensive 50. So they're doing it in their back 50, and they're ranked number two for intercept marks in their forward 50. So those forward 50 tackles that you touched on are resulting in opportunities to mark the ball. They're below average for intercept marks in the attacking half of the midfield. So they're doing it at either end of the ground, not so much in the middle of the ground. By comparison, we're 13th in the AFL for intercept marks. Although, you know, interestingly on that, Fremantle and Sydney, both teams who are going okay, are 17th and 18th. So we're probably still a little bit early in the season to take all that much out of that data, because, you know, one performance either way can sort of skew that a little bit. And all of that does mean, you know, back on the Bulldogs case, that it means that they're scoring well from turnovers. They're averaging 53.75 points a game from turnovers, which is 6.8 points more per game than the AFL average, whereas we're 6 points below the average. So sort of a 12-point, you know, two and a bit goal gap there. They score 3.2 points more than the AFL average from stoppages, and we're about 4.5 points above the AFL average. So we're doing a little bit better there than they are, and they're just below the AFL average for centre clearance scores, whereas we're just above it. So again, we're a little bit better in that regard. They rank 11th in the AFL for tackles. We're 6th. Tackles inside 50, they're 2nd. We're 3rd. Marks inside 50, they're 5th, and we're 8th.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive numbers about the Bulldogs in general. And, you know, you look at their players and, you know, they have pretty big stars on most lines. You'd probably argue the defensive line is probably their weakest point in terms of star quality. But the quality of their top-end players is arguably up there with the best in the league. And they just remain a side I can't get a hold on. I'm pretty sure I've spoken about this last year. I'm getting flashbacks. But they really seem to have all the pieces to be a side that challenges for the flag, yet the last couple of years they've underperformed. Basically, to me, they seem like a team that is less than the sum of their parts. And look, despite that, they've been dominant over the Dons for the past decade, and it's going to require a big change for the Bombers to get up on Friday.
Yeah, it will, mate. It's a bit of a different mix in the midfield for them this year. They're still reliant on Bontempelli, Liberatore and Treloar as their three prime movers in the midfield, and of course Tim English in the ruck. Those three mids have, you know, they attended 81%, 78% and 78% respectively last season, Bontempelli, Liberatore and Treloar. This year they're at 78, 74 and 78. So, you know, come back a little bit in terms of Bontempelli and Liberatore. Treloar's going at exactly the same, but, you know, fundamentally not a lot has changed. What has changed is their midfield depth. So last year, Jack McRae, Bailey Smith, who of course has done his ACL, and Caleb Daniel, who's been dropped from the side this week. Spoiler alert, we haven't got to selection just yet. But they were the next three in the mix for them last season. This year, that's being shared by Riley Sanders, first-year player, Harvey Gallagher, second-year player who debuted in round one, and Jack McRae is then their next midfielder in terms of attendances, but at a lesser percentage than last year. And he started a sub last week. So the depth in their midfield that they want, the top end of their midfield's really still really strong. Riley Sanders is a really, really exciting young talent. He's going to be a star. And Harvey Gallagher's showing really good signs. But we know with young players that they don't have the consistency to perform week in, week out, especially, you know, as genuine AFL midfielders. So, yeah, it is a little bit of a different look in there this year than what it was in the past once you get past the top three. All that said, mate, they made some changes to their list last season, in the off season, I should say. What have they done there?
Yeah, so look, following season 2023, the Dogs made 9 list changes. Josh Bruce retired; he played 8 games that season. Whilst Jordan Sweet was traded to Port Adelaide, but he didn't feature for the Dogs last season, so they weren't losing much in terms of continuity there. 7 others were delisted. No one who played significant minutes. Former Docker Hayden Crozier. Former Hawk Tim O'Brien, former Demon Mitch Hannon, and then 2016 Premiership player Toby McLean. None of those played more than 7 games, and there were 3 others who hadn't featured last year who were delisted. They did bring in 2 other players from other clubs, so James Harnes from Melbourne and Nick Caulfield from St Kilda. So far, they've played 1 and 2 games respectively, and they're not in the side this week either. The Dogs hit the draft hard. They brought in 5 players from the 2023 crop. They traded up to the Suns pick to secure midfielder Riley Sanders, who's played all 4 games this year and will play again on Friday night. The Dogs' controlled breeding program produced yet another father-son with Jordan Croft taken at pick 15. I don't know what they're doing to their former players, but they all seem to breed AFL quality talent. But he's yet to debut, and then they also have 3 other later picks from that draft who are not going to play. You mentioned Bailey Smith's season-ending injury. Off that, the Dogs picked up former Hawk Lachlan Bramble, and he's played all 4 of their games to this point so far this year.
Yeah, I think, you know, we touched on him already. Most listeners will be pretty familiar with Riley Sanders. We'll see him tomorrow night. Lockie Bramble will also see. You know, he's filled a bit of a void at halfback for them. And they've also debuted Harvey Gallagher, I should say, through the midfield, as we've already touched on. So in terms of new players, they're the 3 that we'll see tomorrow night. We probably don't need too much of a reminder from the last time that we met. But, yeah, give us a quick summary, mate. It wasn't that long ago in terms of games since. It was just round 19 last year.
Yeah, and look, Essendon 7-7-49 lost to the Bulldogs 13-12-90 on that day. And, you know, compared to some of the other losses against the Bulldogs, it wasn't the worst loss we've suffered, but still quite a bad one. And look, the game was fairly even for the first half, but then an injury to Jordan Ridley, the first of his quad injuries that have plagued him for the past, you know, 8 to 9 months, saw the Dogs kick away. They kicked the last 4 goals of the game to run out 41-point winners. And as I sort of hinted at, that's the 9th time in the previous 10 games that the Bombers have lost to the Dogs. And the average losing margin in that time is 49 points. So really have not been successful against the Dogs. Both teams had a similar number of possessions and each got 49 inside 50s. However, the Dogs' efficiency of 53% dwarfed the Bombers' 30%. And that was the Bombers' lowest mark for the season in terms of scoring times they went inside 50. The Dogs won 18 more stoppages in the match, and once again, that was Essendon's worst performance for 2023 at stoppage clearance. So we really got belted around the ball there. Essendon's halfback line, because of that Dogs' dominance winning the ball, had to do most of the work. So before going off, Ridley had 29 disposals, Redmond had 28, Laverde 27, and McGrath had 26. So I remember watching back that game, we were really slow in moving the ball around. We were kicking around a lot and taking a lot of marks without really going anywhere. All of our backs had 9 or more marks. Kelly, Laverty, Ridley, Zerk Thatcher, McGrath, Heppel and Redmond, they all had 9 marks. And that's because we really were struggling to move the ball from our back line to our forward line. Looking at the Dogs, Liberatore led the way. He had 36 disposals and 12 clearances. And then in terms of goal kickers, Ugelhagen and Waitman each kicked 3.
Yeah, I mean, we were right in that game for a lot of the night. And, you know, in the end, partly self-sabotage, but also just that star power, wasn't it, of Hugo Hagen, Waitman and Bontempelli was supreme. Halfway through the third quarter, it was only 9 points the difference. And I think that was around about the stage that Jordan Ridley got injured and went off the ground. The Dogs kicked the last two goals of that quarter, took the margin out. We kicked the first goal of the last quarter to bring it back within 14 points. So, we were in the game, but yeah, they took control from there and ran out, with a pretty strong win in the end. So it wasn't to be. Yeah, that's rear vision mirror stuff though, mate. Let's skip forward to present. What's happened at the selection table?
Yeah, so only forced changes this week for Essendon. I know a lot of people have been calling for bigger changes, but it seems like the players that played against Port that are still fit to play are going to get the opportunity to redeem themselves this week. So out goes Will Setterfield with the knee and Archie Perkins for the hamstring, and both look like to be multiple week injuries at this stage. Coming back in from concussion protocols is Sam Durham, and then Alwyn Davey Jr. as well coming in. Last week's sub was Nick Hind. So it'll be interesting to see who they go with the sub this week.
Yeah, as you said, two force changes. Durham obviously picks himself given his form in the first couple of weeks. So I think we can assume that we're going to see more of Hobbs and Caldwell through the midfield. We did, once Perkins went off, Hobbs went into the midfield last week and we saw Caldwell there for a fair bit anyway. I really like that we've added some speed. Nick Hind has his knockers. Deservingly so at times, he's his own worst enemy, but I like that we've retained him and kept his speed and added to it with Alwyn Jr. We don't have a lot of options just at the moment in terms of raw leg speed. I mean, people are going to have different views of this and I completely get it. I'm not surprised that we've turned to a team that performed well against St Kilda 2 weeks ago and it started well against Port last week and have given them a chance to redeem themselves. I'm not a big believer in, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which is such a weird expression in itself. But yeah, I think you need to give guys that have, held up pretty well the first 3 weeks and give them the opportunity to redeem themselves. And that, it looks like that's what we've done. I probably would have liked to have seen Sardis back in, but I can live with it given that he's clearly been dropped to work on parts of his game. And unfortunately, there's just been a lack of VFL games and he hasn't really been able to demonstrate how he's improved in the things that the coaches clearly want to see him work on.
Yeah, it's one of my pet peeves at the moment with the AFL, the way in which the VFL is structured and makes it difficult for teams to get that extra support through the VFL programs, particularly if you're trying to build a good VFL program like we are, that's very stop-start, difficult for players to try and, force their way into the side at the moment. And look, you touched on Alwyn Davey, and it might not mean much because being named on the ground doesn't preclude him from being the sub, but I'm hoping he does get a full game because I really want to see how he goes for a full game. I actually don't think the sub suits him really well at this stage. I think at his age and aspect of development, I think he needs to get a good feel of the pace of the game to get involved, and I don't think he can do that in the sub role. I think he needs to have that full game and really get the legs out and start getting involved a lot more. He did come on against Sydney as a sub and he had that great tackle, but that's really was his only impact in that final quarter there. So hopefully if he does get a full game, he can have much more of an impact and really build into his, build into a game and hopefully get a few weeks under his belt in the AFL side. Looking at the Western Bulldogs, they only made one change. Caleb Daniel, you wouldn't have believed this a couple of years ago, but he's been omitted from the side and they've brought in James O'Donnell, who is the son of Simon, I believe, the former Australian cricketer. Last week's subs, Jack McRae. Interesting to see who they choose as a sub.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. The talk during the week was that we would see Caleb Daniel drop it and he hasn't been in very good form at all, but geez, he's a player that has done a fair bit of damage to us and over the years. And the unfortunate thing about James O'Donnell getting picked up by the Western Bulldogs is that it means he was a loss to Essendon Cricket Club, by the way, so I'm disappointed that played out that way. But yeah, I'm glad that they haven't given Daniel another chance because he's a player that's got hold of us in the past and has all the attributes that tend to hurt us. Mate, you I think am I right in saying you saw a little bit of the Dogs game against the Cats last week live before you had to fly home?
I did actually saw the whole thing. It was the Saturday night. I got to see the Collingwood Hawthorn game was the last one and managed to get out after that, despite Jetstar cancelling my flight. I did manage to get out that night, thankfully. much to the pleasure of my partner, who didn't want to have to look after the kids on their own anymore. So it was good for her, and I did get out. But I did get to see that whole game between the Bulldogs and Geelong. It was a close game for the majority of the night. The Cats doing enough to get over the line. They did get out to a 28-point lead. The Dogs charged hard at the end, kicking five of the last six goals, but they did fall just short. And there was a bit of controversy with the Stengel mark on the line and a review that the goal umpire didn't think was necessary and was overruled by the field umpire. And arguably you can say that the Dogs were a little bit robbed in that game, but at the end of the day, they've come away with a loss there. It wasn't much separating the side statistically. The Dogs had a slight advantage in clearance and contested possessions, but they did give up the ball 10 more times than the Cats. And that was arguably the difference in the end, with the Cats scoring 13 more points from intercept than the Bulldogs did. Each of those three prime midfielders that you brought up earlier had 35 plus disposals. And Libba also had a monstrous 19 clearances, and that's equal third best of all time. Bont led the Dogs in meters gained with 638. You also then have their forward line. Sam Darcy secured the Rising Star nomination with three goals, and Riley West, Cody Waitman, and Jamari Ugle-Hagan kicked two each. So a lot of their threats got dangerous there, but it wasn't enough to get over a really well-drilled Geelong side.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it felt being at the game, but watching on TV, it felt like it was just a game that Geelong sort of kept the Dogs at arm's length for most of the night. They got out to 28 points in front late in that third quarter. Even early in the last, they were still 21 points up before the Dogs, you know, sort of almost against the trend, came storming back and you know, kind of shocked, I think, you know, both sides a little bit that they got as close as they did at the end, and you know, it down to the last minute they were in the ball game. I think, you know, the difference in the game was the ability for the Cats to you know, hold up and execute under pressure, but also score from stoppages, 32 points to 15 in that game, you know, in a game that was otherwise relatively even across the board.
Yeah, so let's turn to our game. And look, on paper, there's a lot that mirrors what we just faced in terms of Port, a strong clearance side with some elite-level midfielders and tall targets in the forward line. As I said, there's a lot of similarities in the way in which the Bulldogs structure up and their list quality compared to Port Adelaide. So arguably we've had a practice run against the Power, so hopefully there'll be some lessons to take out of it coming up against the Dogs. And we've talked about this a lot. Our game is reliant on the ability to win centre clearance and take territory. And we're coming up against some of the best clearance operators in the business, especially Liberatore. He's had 12, 7 and 7 clearances in the last three games he's played against the Bombers. If you go back to our last victory against the Dogs, which was in 2021, he only had two. So how can we manage him so that he's less of a factor this week?
Yeah, I think we need to take the lesson away from what Drew did to us last week and that last victory that you just mentioned that we had against the Bulldogs, where Dylan Clark went to Libba and kept him really quiet and it allowed us to, you know, to have a more of an influence over the midfield. Yeah, we've already spoken about it, but I think in ignoring Drew and starting Merritt forward, we're attempting to drag him away. But what we didn't do was then combat him at the source once it was, you know, obvious that Drew was going to play out as a midfielder. So I'm thinking a little bit out of the box this week. I'm going to set Hobbs the task of stopping Liberatore. The temptation with the Bulldogs is to go to Bontempelli and try and stop him. We tried that with Perkins last time. I think Bontempelli is just too good a player to actually stop. You need to you know, go a layer deeper and yeah, as I've said, stop the ball at the source. Libba himself is a tough player to stop. He gets really low to the ground. He scraps and he fights for every crumb and he thinks faster than most. I also don't think people appreciate how good a kick he is. He doesn't have a lot of depth in his kicking, but yeah, those you know, 20 to 30 meter passes of his are really, really effective. And ultimately, I think he's the player that we want Ben Hobbs to become. He's never going to be pretty beautifully skilled or elegant player to watch, but he can be and should be a real scrapper and fighter and get his hands dirty. So I think it's a really good opportunity for him to early in his career to go up to the best in the business, take him one-on-one, body him, pressure him, get lower than him. And, you know, at times I think it's to his own detriment that Ben Hobbs goes to ground too often. But against a player like Libba, we want him burrowing in there and getting his hands on the ball. And if we can't win a centre clearance, don't lose it. You know, that was another problem for us last week, was that we didn't create enough, you know, stoppages after the first clearance. So, yeah, setting him the task, Ben Hobbs the task this week to try and combat Libba and be really, you know, disciplined in preventing his access to the ball. I also think that, you know, Caldwell and Durham are the other options in that kind of a role, but I think we need them, you know, playing as midfielders outside that contest. We'll need their extra size and spread, you know, not to tag Bont but or Treloar, but to body them and be physical with them. You know, I want to keep their size and to help with the balance around the stoppage. And you know, that spread, Durham and Caldwell are both good at, Hobbs not so much. So I think, you know, Hobbs to Libba, Caldwell and Durham to work with Parrish and Merritt in the next layer of our mids.
Something else that we struggled with against the Power was their tall forward line of Dixon, Marshall, Georgiades and Finlayson. We're coming up against a similarly big forward line this week with Darcy, Ugglehagen and Norton all being high quality players. And so how do we adjust this week to what didn't work last week?
Yeah, a little bit of a different prospect because they don't quite have the physical attributes that we saw last week. You know, Dixon was held goalless by McKay, but he also kept McKay away from I'll get there eventually, I promise. He kept McKay away from being able to intercept and influence too many contests in the air. Norton's been playing up the ground, and I think that's a good opportunity for Nick Cox. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have Nick Cox playing as a key defender. We've been put in that situation because Reed and Ridley aren't available, and Cox is having to play a role that doesn't particularly suit him. He's another one that's been criticised widely in, you know, some of the chatter on socials this week, and I think unfairly. We'd much rather see him building on the role that he's been effective in early in the season on the wing and at half back and playing on a smaller opponent. But that said, he's going to need to do a bit of a job for us. And I think that Norton matchup, getting up the ground a little bit, will suit him. And, you know, he's been learning to read the game better in transition. So by playing on a player that's higher up the ground rather than deep like Port dragged him last week, then he gets the opportunity to drop off and intercept and disrupt a little bit, which he'd been doing pretty well, or you know, go one-on-one with Norton when that's needed. So, yeah, I think that's one matchup. The rest is just going to come down to positioning, really, and Laverde and McKay are going to have to do a really good job, and they'll share Darcy and Ugglehagen at different moments, I'm sure. I don't think it'll necessarily be a one-on-one situation for the game. But yeah, I think, mate, a lot more of it, this is going to be what happened in the midfield and than what's going to happen in our back 50. If we afford the Dogs the spread like we afford a Port, then, you know, doesn't matter who we've got down back. They're not going to be able to hold up.
Yeah. Well, look, let's think about what else we need to watch out for when it comes to the Bulldogs. What are the other things? We've touched on the midfield. We've touched on the key forwards. What else are we concerned about?
Yeah, I think I would hope that we take a lot out of that Port Adelaide game and where it went wrong and we learn from that. But I think Port will as well. You know, Bevo has some flaws as a coach, but I do think he's a good tactician, particularly when it comes to opposition and opposition threats. I think we need a plan on how we free up Mason Redmond if they do send a player to lock down on McGrath like Port did. If that happens, and you know, the AFL is a bit of a game of copycat. Once something happens once and it's effective, other teams tend to follow it. I think if that happens, we just send McGrath to go and play on Waitman. Waitman's their best small forward. He's been in really good form. And then we can use Redmond in a more aggressive role. You know, the whole point of having flexibility and options is to actually deploy them. So let's do that if we find ourselves in that situation. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, someone like West goes to someone like McGrath and tries to curve his influence. So, yeah, let's use the tools that we've got. They've also got some good interceptors down back. And this is where I think they'll back in the way that they played rather than copycat what Port did. I don't think they'll want to lose their intercepting prowess and go to one-on-one. Liam Jones has made a career out of intercept marking, you know, and become a really good player off the back of it. And we shouldn't sleep on Karmas and Jarre either. All three of them are in the top 10 in the AFL for intercept marks. So our usage inside 50 is going to be really important. But I do think they give you looks to goal through smaller forwards. So I think it's a big opportunity for Gresham, for Menzies, for Davey and Hind. I assume one of those three is going to be our sub, but you know, that gives us three, you know, sort of small forward options that I think can have a big impact on the game.
Yeah. Well, look, let's move to our final thoughts and kept it simple this week. Jono, it's a big game for...
Big game for Darcy Parrish, mate. It's his third game back from injury. Our midfield was, you know, obviously soundly beaten last week. I thought he was good against the Saints, you know, particularly defensively, and his work rate, his pressure and tackling was really, really strong, and he got his hands on the footy a bit as well. But he really lowered his colours last week. He needs to elevate his game this week and, you know, demonstrate that he's one of the premier midfielders against the competition and out-trelaw. You know, he needs to be the best spread and running midfielder of the game for us to be a chance to win. What about you?
Yeah, look, you touched on him just before, but I think it's Mason Redmond really needs to have a big game. He's a better player than he's been showing. And with all the difficulties we've had moving the ball from half back, we need him to have a big one this week, you know, running the ball, kicking, you know, moving the ball quickly up the field, making use of that excellent sort of 60-meter player that he is, you know, run 10 meters and kick at 50. I think that's going to be really important this week. Well, look, thanks for everything tonight, Jono. It's been a bit of a marathon one for us. But as always, taking time talking football with you is always a highlight of my week. Before we go, just recommend people keep an eye on our socials for a big announcement coming this Monday. I'm really excited to let people know what we've been planning. Jono, any final words from you?
Yeah, look, mate, thank you. It's very kind of you to say, and ditto. It's been a lot of fun, and it always is. A bit of nervous energy heading into tomorrow night. You know, hoping for the best, expecting the worst. But yeah, let's hope we see a strong response, mate. And you know, we can leave the ground feeling proud of how we've gone about it. Thanks again to everyone for the support and for all the work that you put in, Humie. Really appreciate it, mate. And yeah, look forward to that special announcement on Monday.
Yeah, I am too. Look, everyone, as always, stay safe and go Dons.